Let's talk about our beliefs and what we can learn about them. There is truth. We believe nature is solid and time a constant. Matter has substance and time a direction. There is truth in flesh and the solid ground. The internet may be invisible, but it's real. And we assume time is narrow because it is as a clock. 1 second is 1 second for every Twitter account. Cause precedes effect. Fruit rots. Trolls flow downstream. We're born. We age. We podcast. We die. The reverse never happens. None of this is true. Say goodbye to classical reality because our logic collapses on the subatomic level into ghosts and shadows and another episode of The Last Knock.
Nice.
I am Professor Johnny Numb. Welcome to my class. And joining me tonight, as always, with that awesome handlebar mustache is.
Billy Crash.
Come on, Billy, admit it. You want to look like Jameson Parker did in 1987.
Oh, man. Oh, that's caca.
I hate to tell you, Billy, but this is real bullshit.
Yeah. He's a real case. But that was very good, Victor Wong. Very good.
Any case, that opening monologue is a slight rewording of a monologue from John Carpenter's 1987 classic Prince of Darkness.
Absolutely.
And I would say maybe a bit of an unsung classic.
You just said it.
Oh, geez. More so maybe in its time, it wasn't definitely wasn't given the sort of recognition by critics or box office that
No.
it deserved. And we can kind of get into that. I think it's kind of
Let's do it.
there's some points to be made about that. But
Yeah.
well. Yeah, I mean, essentially, I'll give a brief synopsis of the film.
Yeah,
I've seen it.
it's his 30-year anniversary.
Yeah, and that's why we're doing this show. This is one of our macabre milestone shows.
Damn
And,
straight.
this is a movie we bring up definitely once every couple of shows, I feel. So, in any case, it's essentially about an intersection between faith and physics. A bunch of college physics students in Los Angeles are drafted by the church to investigate some strange goings on in the basement of an abandoned church in kind of a seedy section of the city. In the basement of this church is this canister filled with a swirling green liquid that, I never get this right, Bill, even though the movie mentions it. Is it Satan or the son of Satan in that canister?
It is Satan himself. Old Scratch knocking at the door.
Excellent. So essentially, John Carpenter, who wrote the film under the pseudonym Martin Quatermass after the Quatermass experiment films, he also directed this, and he directed it sort of in his inimitable style
Oh, yeah.
of getting a bunch of people together, putting them in a enclosed location, and letting all hell break loose.
Damn straight.
So that's essentially the basic plot setup, and we will definitely be picking apart more of that in detail as we go along. But back to your point, Bill. Why do you think that Prince of Darkness was maybe not was maybe given the cold shoulder in 1987 when it was released?
I really can't tell you. That's one of the things I don't get. When it comes to something like that, where it's like, how did this get lost in the shuffle? It's like, what do we do? Do we blame Universal Pictures and their marketing department? Yes, we do. So that's what I'm doing. I was just, thinking of. I've always wondered why it didn't make it, because I didn't even remember it, to be honest. And that's not like me, when it comes to this. But like in 1987, we did have some stellar horror movies that really rampaged on screen. Hellraiser, yeah. The Lost Boys, Evil Dead 2. Well, Creepshow 2. But, you know.
Was Monster Squad that year,
yep,
too?
Monster Squad, A Nightmare on Elm Street 3. Okay. Near Dark was out. The Gate, which is also little known for a lot of people. The Stepfather, you know, Bad Taste. But Predator was super gigantic. What was it? Prom Night 2, which is one of my guilty pleasures. House 2, the second story. Man, what else? Street Trash.
Yeah.
The Hidden, which was gigantic. Return to Horror High. Angel Heart, which was huge. And, you know, like, you know, stuff like that. Jaws the Revenge. Oh!
Greatest movie ever, by the way.
Yahoo! Dolls. The Great Dolls from Stuart Gordon, Necromantic, but I don't recall that ever being in theaters.
Well, I mean, if it was just like in Europe, I'd say.
Yeah, probably, and you know, we had like you know The Witches of Eastwick and you know, a comedy and The Believers, yeah. The Believers, Howling 3, but you know, it's just there were a lot of you know decent ones at least, Creepazoids, you know, that remember from that time, and like Creepazoids, how could you forget it? But so I don't know, but I think, you know, it comes down to, I think the marketing, because I really don't remember it. And my buddy Don Reamer, an excellent editor, airworthy.com, he has that for a plug. You know, he's like, Bill, man, you got to take another look at, you know, Prince of Darkness. And I'm like, yeah, all right. You know, and I put it in and I'm like, holy shit. Like, dude. Wait,
How long ago was this, Bill?
I forgot how many years ago, but it was
okay, it's been a while. Okay.
Yeah, now it's one of my go-to horrors, you know? Like, I'm feeling, you know, like, I'll put in, you know, like, The Thing, and I'll put in Prince of Darkness, and Anthony Brownrigg's
Red Victoria,
you know, stuff like that. And, but like, Prince of Darkness, like, at one point, I was watching it once a week.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Like some people, like they always talk about, yeah, I love John Carpenter. Great. What are your favorite films? And I mentioned The Usual Suspects, and it's like, and I'm like, no, he didn't direct that one. And
Kaiser Soze, Bill. Yeah.
And it's like this doesn't come up, and some you know, hardcore fans of his. No, well, I mean, all hardcore fans have seen this, but like you know, other yeah, I'm a fan of him and all. Really, did you see that one? Well, no, not yet. I'm like, what are you waiting for?
Yeah, you know, Bill, there's a weird... I feel like there is kind of a weird couple subsections of Carpenter fans in a way.
Yeah.
Like, you have the people who are understandably, like, all about the Carpenter and Kurt Russell collaborations.
Sure.
Which I would say are probably, with the exception of Halloween, his most iconic, you know, his iconic works, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have the people who are just like all about his early like 70s stuff or early 80s stuff. And,
right.
You know, and I feel like a lot of people aren't really into the stuff he did in the 90s. So I'm wondering if Prince of Darkness kind of came at the end of a cycle for him. Like, I know he's talked about how Universal gave him the Romero deal where it's like,
yeah,
we'll give you a low budget, but we'll give you total control over your film.
Right.
You know, which is something he really liked, apparently, about doing Prince of Darkness, because I think he kind of acknowledged what the project was and what he could do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's also something he's fond of saying, like he's very self-deprecating when you see him in interviews all these years after the fact. He's saying, yeah, like none of my movies did well at the box office and now everybody loves them, kind of. It's like they didn't have the life, you know, in mainstream cinema. At that time that they would have maybe if they came out now. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, when you look at like The Thing and all, I mean, 1982 was a super gigantic, phenomenal year for films.
Yeah.
And that was just like any other year, The Thing would have exploded. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I saw it, its opening weekend, I think, it was, you know, the place was packed, but then, you know, you had that little friggin', you know, E.T. shit running around and all, and that just ate up every friggin' screen across the world. And,
yeah.
you know, so, you know, timing and, you know, when was it released? Let's see. This was released on October 23rd, 1987.
That's
so, right. Yeah. And so the timing was right. But if there were other, you know, like, you know, Hellraiser maybe was released that day or some shit like that. And it's like, oh, you know, and there was just some, you know, big time, you know, Clive Barker competition and all that. And it just, that's the way it was.
Well, Bill, what do you think about this idea? As I mentioned in my expert synopsis, sarcasm there.
A little bit.
For a good stretch of the film, the villain or the monster in the film is this huge canister of a swirling green liquid. Now, do you think that's part of the problem? I know the film was, I think the film was marketed pretty strangely because of the, of that. Like, I don't know. Maybe it was a problem with Universal being like, okay, we gave John Carpenter all this creative control. Now we have a movie we can't market.
You're right.
In a good way. Yeah.
Well, you're right because, you know, it's not your typical antagonist. It's not, it's something, you know, really tangible yet. It's the pea soup. It's the vomit from friggin', you know, Reagan and William Friedkin's The Exorcist contained in a jar that's ancient, looked over by the Brotherhood of Sleep, and it's like, what the hell is going on? But Alice Cooper's in it, man. Let's go. You know, like, that would have been, they should have just said, Alice Cooper, and holy shit, man. You know, like, people would have come out, like, by the millions just to see that.
I was going to say it worked for Monster Dog.
Damn straight.
Again. Sarcasm again.
Yeah, I know, I got it. But I don't, you know, because it was, and it's unique in so many ways, you know, where this isn't even your typical John Carpenter horror movie. It sort of goes down that path, but, you know, he takes a whole different tact. You know, he's like, you know, science plus religion equals, you know, fighting evil, maybe. You know, it's like,
right.
You know, and I really enjoyed for the scientific aspect. It's like, in ways I wish the whole movie was sort of like suspenseful like that until the very end. And it's okay that it isn't, but because I still love the film very much. But it's different, you know, and I think a lot of people like expecting, oh yeah, Carpenter, man, there's going to be blood and gore everywhere, blah, 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 blah. And for the first 45 minutes, that's not the case.
There's a lot of, I would say there's a lot of table setting in this movie.
But it's cool, though. You know, I loved it. I thought it was really neat.
Yeah. I'm not saying I have a problem with it because...
No, I know you didn't.
Yeah, because I like the build of things in movies. I don't like it when you're, like, immediately smacking people over the head with stuff.
Tachyons.
Exactly. And, you know, that's another... I was going to bring that up, Bill. This is, like, one of two movies where I've heard the word tachyon used and tachyons used as an actual concept within the film, so I'm pretty impressed by that.
if you want to find out what they are, ladies and gentlemen, watch the movie.
Exactly. Or we'll probably tell you eventually.
Maybe. I don't wanna.
But Bill, I'm kind of curious, what was your first exposure to, like, how old were you, like, how did you watch it? I'm guessing on video. Like, when did you first see Prince of Darkness?
Well, that's the thing. I didn't see Prince of Darkness until, I can't remember if I had seen it before my buddy told me about it again.
Oh, okay.
And that would be 2012, maybe?
Holy shit. Okay.
I'm not kidding you. It just got totally lost. It's like, you know, like, it's like, to me, like, you know, watching horror films and stuff, it was like I ran a stop sign and didn't know it. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, dude, you just ran past Prince of Darkness. No shit, really? Yeah, you just ran through Prince of Darkness. No way, man. Yeah, and then, you know, because I can't recall seeing it before that.
Do not pass Prince of Darkness. Do not collect huge canister of green fluid.
Yay!
well, you know, that's interesting, Bill. I had no idea that was your history with the film, because I know I rented it on VHS like in my late teens. You know, it was a movie I kind of dismissed when I first saw it. Cause I think like you were getting at, it's a much headier film than I think people give it credit for, especially the mainstream critics.
Agreed.
who are just looking to kind of, it's like, it's just another, it's John Carpenter. We know what to expect from him. It's just the same old, same old. No, and especially with this film, which I think, like you said, is especially unique among his filmography, even though it calls back to a lot of his favorite tropes as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think when I first watched it, I was like, a lot of the dialogue was going over my head because it is kind of a, I would say kind of
heady.
Yeah, it's kind of dense with concepts. And it's not that the concepts aren't explained, but you have to kind of, it's not like a dumb slasher film where you can just like sit back and enjoy the carnage. It's like you kind of got to listen to what the characters are saying and what they're trying to convey of this seemingly inexplicable phenomenon they're encountering.
Oh, you're right. You can't blow off the dialogue in this thing.
Yeah, and that's something that I think is kind of intriguing about it, because it is kind of, you know, a bit eggheady maybe, but...
yeah, but it's it is to a point, but not that bad. It isn't,
no.
You know? And, you know, Dennis Dunn is in there, you know, as Walter to, like, you know, keep things grounded a little bit, and...
Oh, my God, his you know, I wanted to look into, like, his... what he did before he started acting. If he were a stand-up comedian, I would not be surprised in the least.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I laugh at his one-liners every time I watch this movie. Yeah. I fucking love his character so much.
Hey, did anyone ever tell you look Asian? It's like,
what it's this totally it almost seems like an improvised line that Carpenter left in the film, but it gets me every time when he says, "I have to go to the bathroom."
Yeah, I know, and but I could see that being a real thing too, and it's funny and like, oh, I get it, man.
Yeah. You know, I can't go out that door, but I got to go to the bathroom. And what am I going to do? Shit in the corner? Yeah,
I know. And he talking about homosexual panic and all this crazy. He was like. Oh, man, I have serious plans for this weekend. You know, it's just like, it's great because he's a grad student or trying to earn his doctorate. And he's like, fuck this, man. You know, it's like awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, the dialogue, it's interesting for Carpenter, because I think when you listen to him do interviews about this film, he's like saying, oh, I just read a book on quantum mechanics, and that was the inspiration. So.
Yep, exactly, and that's cool. I love it, and what I really love about it is the whole thematic presence of the film. Is you have a priest played by the great, late, awesome Donald Pleasance, who goes to Victor Wong, who's Professor Howard Burak, and he's like, after the death of this priest, and he learns of this Brotherhood of Sleep, and he finds this, like, condemned but still kept, you know, Roman Catholic Church, and here's the key to the kingdom. And it's great because it's like, here's the key to Pandora's box. Do we really want to go in there? And no, they go in. He's like, explain this shit, because, you know, he's like, we need to tell the world, and we need to. I need scientific verification that this is the devil.
Yeah, you know what, Bill? One of my a line that I really like is there are a couple interesting scenes with between Victor Wong and Donald Pleasance. It's just like a two shot. It's the two of them in the pastor's study of the church talking.
Yeah,
and just as an aside, I kind of like how Victor Wong is in the seat the pastor would be sitting in, and Donald Pleasance is in the seat the student would be sitting in.
Yes, exactly.
But when Byrak, the Victor Wong character, says the outside world doesn't want to hear this kind of bullshit, just seal it up. You managed to do that for like 2,000 years, and I love that line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, don't go kicking, you know, don't go poking the bear kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. My scientific expertise says, leave it alone, you know, and it's almost like, oh, I don't really want to know that. You know, it's like, you know, I want to believe in other things. And that was really a cool thing, because it comes down to this battle. Like, can science and religion together combat and defeat the great evil? And that's the cool thing. It's like war makes for strange bedfellows. And here you have, you know, the priest and the professor you know, locking arms and doing their best. And the interesting thing is, it's just Donald Pleasance. Like, he's the sole, he's a rebel, man. He's like the sole rep of the church and everything else. There's no one else is around him. No one of power beyond him. You know, no one else from the church, like, you know, working together to like, yeah, let's view this. And, you know, here's a representative from Vatican City, and none of that's there. It's pretty much all the scientists and, you know, their equipment trying to figure out what the hell is this thing. and the one thing that always bothered me about the film, though, and I would like, it was like you set up all this equipment, you're analyzing this thing, but no one is in the room with it.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, and if there had been a line like, just in case for everyone's safety, I don't want anybody in there, that would have been great. But if you're a scientist, like, you want to get as close to the object as you can.
I think you would almost want to, like, if you were to do it differently, I would say almost like have like a buddy system like they did in The Thing. Like, never have just one person down there. Like, have maybe two or three people watching what's happening, and then, you know, have them relieved a couple hours later, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. But I sort of do like how, it was a dingy area and stuff like that. Like, I could excuse it, you know, and say, like, okay, we're going to be up, this is going to be our headquarters here. All the material, that everything that we see, you know, we get all the information here, although they didn't have a video camera on it, you know, which sort of bugged me too. But,
They lit it up, but they didn't. Yeah.
So there's like certain things about it that like are like a little ooh, like I wish. But it doesn't take away from the coolness of the movie, its power, its atmosphere, any elements of it, the characters, you know, the music, you know, from John Carpenter and Alan Haworth, you know, just really awesome, And it was great to see, like, Jameson Parker, who went on to do Simon and Simon, and, playing his part with this giant mustache, you know, and, like, the Sam Elliott mustache on his face, and being a student, and being attracted to, Lisa Blount's character, and, Danforth,
I'm kind of curious, what did you think of, Lisa Blount, who plays Catherine Danforth in the film, she's an extremely interesting character because she's, you have a feeling she's like very academic and very, I just get this feeling every time I watch that she's very existentially consumed. Because there's this odd scene with her and Jameson Parker where it's kind of like, it's kind of sort of like a getting to know you type thing. He's trying to flirt with her, but she's like talking about how I put it in a box, and then it's like I'm back to seeing regular classical reality again. And it's not the sort of conversation you expect to have when you're getting to know someone, and Jameson Parker quickly makes a joke that she takes as being sexist, and sort of ruins the mood. So it's kind of intriguing how her character is established. Like, it's like I always wondered, like, what is her deal? I almost want I hate to say this, I almost want a prequel where we get to know more about her character. But
it sounds like she didn't have necessarily great relationship with somebody in the past. Like, you know, she doesn't want, you know, after, you know, in the morning when he get up and he's got the coffee and stuff, she's like, dude, like, let's not go into anything regarding togetherness. That you mentioned the L word, I'm going to jump out the window kind of thing, you know. You just have, like, she had either a bad experience or she's still hung up on somebody who let her go, and she's totally immersed in school and physics. And, there's something standoffish about her character, and there's something, you know, she's definitely protecting herself, like the green thing swirling in that container.
Well, and I think she's
locked from the inside.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's something about her, I think she wants to let a certain part of herself out.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just like she has good cause to keep everything kind of locked up, you know, not unlike the canister, not unlike the panic room in the church kind of thing.
Sure. We all have our own demons, right?
Yeah. And the line that Yeah, the line you're referring to that Jameson Parker has of, you know, who was he, the one who gave you such a high opinion of men? And she just, it's, she gives him a non-answer basically of, I don't want either one of us to jump to conclusions. And it's great.
Yeah.
I love it because it's just adding more to the movie. It's adding more to this,
you know,
in addition to the sense of mystery of the thing in the basement of the church, there is the mystery of the characters themselves, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Because it's funny, on the one hand, we know them and we care about them, but we don't know them at all.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the ambiguity with Catherine kind of, you know, it, like I said, plays into the film as a whole, but it, there are certain like connections I was making the last time I watched it, which was a couple days ago. But I'm sorry, Bill, you were saying something.
I don't know. It doesn't matter. Whatever. go right to it, Johnny.
No, you brought up like a bunch of things and I was like, oh, we could talk about either any of those.
Her being hurt or something like that, but something, there's some sort of damage there. And it's cool because, you know, she knows it's like, okay, it's me, it's not you. Mm-hmm. And so she doesn't, you know, she has the grand opportunity to just like push him away, but she doesn't. It's not that she fully embraces him, at least not at that point in the story. But, you know, she doesn't, you know, she doesn't, you know, lock the door on him, so to speak.
Yeah. You know, actually what I was going to say, Bill, is you were mentioning like her personality and the locked nature of the canister.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And something that I thought was interesting to your point about how it can only be opened from the inside.
Yeah.
Okay. They discover this. And my brain was like, okay, so right there, it's almost like Carpenter is saying, neither science nor faith has any sway over what this thing does.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful.
And I found that kind of, because I never, yeah, frightening. And I, and it's like, because you have all of these moving parts, all of these people, you know, everybody's doing their own thing, working on a certain component. Mm-hmm. of this investigation, as it were.
Right.
You know, it's like, I'm sure there's like not a lot of, not all the conversations are getting lost just among people. You know, it's like you're only a couple times you see everyone as a group in the sanctuary, which is converted into a sanctuary of technology, basically.
Yeah.
Put towards, investigating the phenomenon. And I kind of like that. It's like some people complain about, it's like, oh, people wander off by themselves and stuff. And why are they being so stupid? But it's before any sort of threat really presents itself.
Well, a lot of them aren't taking it seriously. Like when they're told like what they're studying, they're like, get the fuck out of here. You know, like,
yeah,
you know, this is caca. You know, like, you know, the one guy's like, I'm leaving now with this crap. You know, it's bullshit, man. You know, and it's like, and that's what you have. And I could see that happening, you know?
Yeah, so that's a really good point too, Bill. Because like there are some who are like, I don't know what, you can tell they're like weary about the whole thing. But it's like they kind of maybe do believe that something like beyond their, you know, beyond their capacity to explain logically is down there. So
yeah, and that's it, you know. Through their little science, you know, they're getting some reports that this doesn't really add up, you know, like, you know, what's going on? And it's like, so the mystery compels them. And
yeah,
and that's pretty much it, you know. And that's why, you know, Jameson Parker, so, you know, into it. And, you know, we even get, you know, you know, Dennis Dunn's character Walter, he gets into it too. And
I love when he says, is it just me, or do you think we're stroking ourselves really heavy here?
Yeah, and he looks so cool too in the whole movie, man.
And you know, it's sort of an aside to the film, though, Bill. Like, but it goes to it's sort of keeping in step with Carpenter's sort of use of similar actors and similar crew, in his films. Because I believe it was Big Trouble in Little China the year before this.
Yeah, and that was with, of course, Victor Wong and Dennis Dunn as well, and that's one of my favorite Carpenter films overall.
Yeah, so I bet Carpenter was just like, you know, these guys are cool. Hey, I'm going to I wonder if he even wrote the parts for these guys, for Prince of Darkness.
No, I don't know, but I thought it was really great to put, you know, Victor Wong in such a really cool part, you know, like, you know, like to put him at like, the, you know, the top of the food chain, so to speak, you know, him and Donald Pleasance are the big cats in the room, you know, and I just thought it was great. Yeah, you're going to be my professor, man. You know, like you're going to be doctor, and you're going to be the one who, like, you know, keeps it rolling and, you know, helps move everybody along. And he's great. He's great. He's like, I could see him as a professor. He's perfect.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he really nailed that look. I totally agree, Bill. And I was like thinking to myself, watching it the last time around, I was like, that's a pretty, you know, neither Victor Wong nor Donald Pleasance, God bless him, you know, neither one of them are really leading men in the conventional sense. And that's sort of an understatement.
And that's another beauty of the horror genre.
Yeah, it affords guys like them the opportunities to, you know,
to shine and have the spotlight without, you know, worrying about, like, did I have these chiseled looks and all this other crap.
Yeah, it's like they're getting an opportunity. And I think what you said about Victor Wong is spot on, because, you know what, I hate science. I'm terrible at science and math.
Oh, really?
I would take his class, because hell, Jameson, yeah. Parker at one point has the great line, you know, he's ruthless. He wants philosophers, not scientists.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah.
No, it's funny because I suck at math too, but I love science. And I wish my math skills had been decent enough, because I love physics. You know, I'm one of those guys, I watch the Science Channel like crazy, but it's like, I can't. Okay, man, write this equation down. I'd just sob. It'd be over. I can't do it. Because I was originally a geology major.
Oh, okay.
All yeah, right. Had rocks in my head. But yeah, I was stupid. But anyway, it was true. But no, and I think it was really cool because you know, this is really a different kind of horror movie where you have that whole scientific element. I love it for that. It just adds this. It's like to see fear in a different kind of arena. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's a good point, Bill. Because, you know, you think back to something like Reanimator, which I think was like maybe that year or the year before. Yeah, and that film is a film that has science fiction elements to it as well. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like the science is a foregone conclusion in that film. It's like Herbert West has this reagent, and it's not really questioned how he made it. It's just
he has it
there. Yeah, it's there, you need it for the plot, basically. So
yeah, and this was the first time we didn't have a mad scientist. It was great to see science without a mad scientist. Like, you know, it wasn't like Victor Wong's like, "We're going to unleash the beast from the container." Like, you know, it's like, come on, you know, that wasn't there at all. It's like, what is it? How can we prove that it exists? Can we keep it contained? You know, all this great stuff, and I love it, man.
Yeah, and something I like about Victor Wong is how he's pretty level-headed throughout the whole thing, even as things escalate.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I love him. He's got what's he got? He's shaking the can, you know. Like he's getting all prepared. Like when people are coming through the door, you know, he's like.
I mean that had to have been scripted, but I'm like wondering, where did Carpenter get that idea from?
It was awesome.
Yeah,
it was awesome, and it was great. It was just like, do what you can in the moment where you have to survive. What can I do to survive? Okay, I'm gonna do the soda can thing, and you know, he had a pencil at the ready too. He had something, I don't know, but
you know what I was watching closely this last time? It's actually a chopstick, I guess, from their Chinese takeout.
Ah, okay, all right, that's cool.
Because I always thought it was a pencil too.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So he's ready. He's ready for war, baby, and it all works. You know, and it's like, well, we got to do what we got to do. So kill him. You know, it's like, wow. But when you know, thinking about it, it's like, and it was great too. That's what I loved in the movie. Is like when shit happens to people, and these other people are witnessing. It's not like, oh man, look what happened to Tom. It's like, holy shit, get me out of here. You know, people are freaking out. And I love it. It's really like hitting them like, oh my God, this person was just like killed in front of me. He just like ripped his throat out or whatever. Oh my God. You're like, they're freaking out. And then they like, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay. I want to live now. So it's like, I got to defend myself any means necessary. So I love those elements of panic and fear because I thought it was very genuine.
Yeah, the film really epitomizes the fight or flight mentality really well.
Oh yeah, beautifully stated. Yeah, absolutely. It was so cool the way he did it, you know, and just the looks on people's faces, like even Jameson Parker's like, I don't want to be here, man. And then later on when he has a chance to like, you know, play hero to a degree, he's getting his ass kicked. You know, it's like he's getting like shoved up against the wall and you can like he's grunting like, oh God, can I hold on? It's like, and I just loved it. To me, it was so genuine, that little scuffle, because it wasn't some, oh yeah, man, I'm gonna throw a right and take this guy out and all. No, it's like, oh, I gotta hold on to him as he crushes me, and like, oh, I hope I don't get, you know, pummeled. And it was just really, I liked it because it, to me, it just seems so real.
No, I agree with you, Bill. And the thing is, like, the only thing that's really superhuman or outside of humanity and has that power is the green goo, basically.
The green goo, baby. Yeah, the green
And
goo and its power over the creatures, well, semi great and small, like a bag
speaking of
lady and street schizo. That's the actual name of Alice Cooper's character, Street Schizo.
Well, what do you think about that, Bill? Because one of Jameson Parker's lines in the film is how it's reaching out, it's
Yeah,
influencing, which you can
right.
apply to the schizophrenics, and you can apply to like the worms that are on the windows
Oh
and the
yeah.
beetles and stuff like that. What do you think all of that means?
Hello. Hello. Sorry. Well, I thought that was really cool because it's showing that the I don't know, this could be a broader socio-political statement. It could be that you know, the unintelligent, the uninformed are easier influenced than those who are.
Well, and I had something to piggyback off of with that. And do you think there's any
I had to, man. I had to do something.
louder, boy, louder.
Oh my God. Wee! Sorry.
something, and I might be totally off with this. Do you
Probably.
think there's any sort of metaphor going on with the fact that the influence of the devil is transmitted through spit, and
Yeah.
there's also the wound the one character gets, and she winds up essentially being infected by the influence, and she becomes the conduit, the human conduit for the devil.
Like it, you know, it's taking advantage of weaknesses, right? Exploiting
Yeah.
weaknesses, yeah. I like that. That's
Do
pretty
you think?
cool. Yeah.
Okay.
I wasn't,
Yeah.
it's funny, I wasn't thinking of the spit, but like, you know, well, there is a fluid exchange. It's a bizarre way of sex, isn't it?
Well, and I was thinking, you know,
Launching
this was.
sperm, spitting. Ooh, wow. Boy, ooh, man. It's just got creepier, man.
Well, I mean, you think of it. I was thinking even like in the notion of like it being a really big time for the AIDS epidemic, probably, and. How and then it's like there's this overarching thought I had of like, well, is the devil itself like just the concept of evil just its own sort of infection kind of that could just spread indefinitely, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, doubt, fear, paranoia, it's all like none of these things are tangible, and it's just like you know, does the if devil exists, you know, does the devil even need to do anything but just hint that I might be here, and is that enough? You know, that's going into Kaiser's O'Shea territory, right?
Oh yeah. The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Ta-da! You know, and again, we have this whole Pandora's canister type of thing where it's like, you know, you let him out, what are you going to have? You know, and it's like, and it this is, goes falls right into the thing, you know, John Carpenter's version of what he was doing. It's like, well, if we let it off this the Antarctic, it's, you know, it's going to like take over the world in like what, 27,000 hours or something like that. And it's like, well, what do you do? How do you contain something like this? And could you convince people that it's real? And yeah, it's going to mimic my brother. I'll know it's my brother or not. Like, get out of here. You know, like you could imagine like nobody buying into it. And that's maybe the greatest horror.
Well, you know, I totally agree with you, Bill, and there are definite similarities between the Thing and Prince of Darkness. And something I like is Jameson Parker has this line after he's talked about the tachyons with the group.
Oh yeah.
Where he's like, you know, someone has finally shown up to tell us. And it's kind of chilling the context of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody is having the same dream, and they're getting a little more information with each dream,
yeah,
leading up towards this inevitable reveal. But when he says, I think we should stand up for what we are, it's very reminiscent of Kurt Russell saying, like, I think we should, you know, what you were saying, like the speech he gives about it's going to be 100 below, that Thing just wants to wait for the rescue party to come,
yeah,
you know, and thaw out. So, you know, I think it's really interesting because there's that altruism there as well. They realize mm-hmm. they're implicated in something far greater than they are.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what do? Are you going to leave? Well, you can't because the schizophrenics blocked all the exits. Or are you going to stay and stand up for yourself as best as you can? Are you going to go down fighting, in other words?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, the only thing protecting the world as we know it is us. So, you know, what are we going to do? And that was great. Yeah. And you know what? No one really argued. At one point, anyway.
Well, something I liked, Bill, was that there was, I think you mentioned this earlier, there was none of that petty, obnoxious bullshit where characters just argue for the sake of arguing in this film.
Right.
You know, it's very, when there are disagreements, you know, these are scientists and it's a priest. So the level of discourse is a bit maybe...
more refined?
A bit more refined, maybe a bit more... I'm trying to think of
logical.
A word. Considerate. These are people who sit in lecture halls and stuff like that, so they learn to listen to other people and what they have to say, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I've seen academics argue before, and, you know, once in a while someone's emotional, but usually it's like, you know, they say fuck you in the politest of ways. You know
yes.
what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. So. We'll agree to disagree or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, and it was just such just a really cool approach of like if something like this happened, they're in Los Angeles, yet they're completely cut off, they're completely isolated, they can't get out.
No one out there can help us, Bill.
Yep, exactly. They're actually, you know, theoretically 1,000 miles from nowhere, man. And you know, and you know, they can't. They're cut off. And they have this incredible opportunity to, you know, to see, like, you know, like what evil like really is. They're really looking into Pandora's box, and
yeah.
I think that's really one of the coolest things. And one of the wonderful things about Pandora's box story is that the last thing to come out of that box was hope.
Mm.
And I've always had a problem with that because I can't stand when people say, oh, I hope something good happens. And because they make it hope actually a word of inaction. And it's like, I'm going to just like sit on my ass and not do a thing and wait. And it's like, well, you're going to be waiting forever because you're not doing anything to elicit such hope. And it's great because you have this sense in the end of maybe, you know, keeping... old Scratch at bay a little bit longer, and that might not be the case.
You know, Bill, that's a really great observation because I used to be the king of I hope statements. and I used to use it sort of as sort of a way to, you know, of course I've learned my lesson, but I was like, oh, someone's upset, I'm gonna feed them a bunch of crap just because I don't know what else to do, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, I hope things work out for you, which is, like you said, it's pretty much a worthless, you know, a worthless sentiment. So, you know, anybody can say it. It's like the equivalent of quote unquote thoughts and prayers these days. So, mm-hmm. but I forgot where I was going with that.
No, well, that's actually a good thing because at one point in the movie, we have Donald Pleasance, the priest, who pretty much finds a place to hide and cower. And, You know, and he, what does he do? He resorts to prayer instead of resorting to what he can really do. And which leads to certain things.
Well, Bill, that's something I did want to talk about. The scene there, it's a scene before the cowering scene, but it's when, is he giving a benediction or the last rites to Calder, who's killed himself?
Yeah, Jesse Lawrence Ferguson. Yeah.
Oh, he's fucking awesome. I love that guy.
Oh yeah, he's like
he's in a
Mona Lisa. Sorry, go ahead, Ben.
His high pitched squealing laugh is one of the creepiest things in that movie.
Oh yeah, and he's a big guy. You know, he's such a foreboding figure, and it's like, and it's great because you see everybody like looking up and going, oh, you know, like when he's coming towards them and all, you know, and he like. And with the whole chair scene, him breaking that part off, and people like, and again, they had that whole, like you said, fight or flight, that push-pull thing, like, no, 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 and like reaching towards him and wanting to pull away. It was like, yeah. it was awesome, man.
Yeah, it's perfect. In that scene where he, near the end, where he's looking at the mirror in that room, and he's it's like, there's so much done with body language and expressions in this film, because
absolutely.
I'm like, yeah, there's like not a lot that's explicitly explained, I would say, you know, with these characters. So it's really interesting to try to surmise what's going on inside their possessed heads at a given moment. But to what you were saying, Bill, about back to Donald Pleasance, do you feel like I feel like he is having a crisis of faith throughout the film that kind of...
Yeah.
Deteriorates, but again, he has sort of the element of ambiguity going on. He's just listed as priest in the credits, though other people are like, oh, it's Father Loomis in a callback to Halloween.
Oh God, don't even go there. Oh yeah.
No, I've heard that. People, I don't know where that came from.
Father Loomis, no.
Yeah, the technical. He's technically just referred to as priest.
Right, exactly. Yeah, keep those characters and those universes separate.
Yeah.
Please, I beg of you.
The John Carpenter cinematic universe.
Yes, exactly.
But the scene where he is reading from the Bible, what did you feel was going on there near the end, Bill? He is shrouded in darkness. He's cowering in the shadows. Some could say he's just hiding in general from the horror around him.
Yeah.
Now, do you feel like he was making a concentrated effort, you know, to do what he could, or do you feel like he was just like, because at one point he's kind of like, he's tearing up, he's looking up at the ceiling saying, "Where are you?" to God.
Desperation, yeah. Fear taking over.
Exactly. I mean, do you feel like, you know, do you feel like he's kind of like, off, we're just fucked and whatever I'm doing is not going to help? Is that, you know, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is when most people pray, in fact, the norm in any religion is to close your eyes and to immerse yourself in it. So if you're immersed in prayer and you're praying for something to happen, then you're divorcing yourself from the world around you, and you're hoping that this entity that you're, you know, calling to will come to the rescue. And, you know, some people, I think, you know, they do it, they may do it naturally. And I think in this case, because he had been like so desperate that he was saying, okay, that's it. I'm going to do what I was told. I'm going to pray to God. I'm going to close my eyes and all this is going to go away. It was almost like he became childlike for a little bit. And I think for him at that moment, that was like he felt like he was convincing himself, like, yeah, I'm doing the right thing. I'm calling upon the Lord to save us. So, you know, that's me. That's my strength, and I'm the priest here. And so, I'm doing my part. You know, when maybe he needed to be more of a man at that point and rock and roll with that nice little axe he had.
Like, if he would have done what he did later, sooner, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, sometimes, you know, people, you know, we've seen that before where, you know, someone is like, you know, like, you know, I don't know, we're a group of people and someone's like, yeah, let's bust their heads in, man, or something, you know, and like, there's always this, yeah, let's do it. And that guy who's saying that is like the guy who's really hanging out in the back and like, he's not really advancing or anything like that. You know what I mean?
Well it's kind of like that scene in Carrie where they go to the pig farm and the guy who's all gung ho about bashing the pig's head in, just like, he's just like, oh, I can't do it at the last second.
Yeah. Yeah. He stirs the pot. They're a pot stirrer. You know, they stir the pot and then they step back.
Yeah, exactly. So he could have used a bit more of that pot stirring, but with the follow through.
Yeah, because if he had acted sooner, certain things might have been different.
Yeah, and you know, Bill, I've got a couple other things to bring up in a greater, just the greater, grander scheme of things.
Do it! Do it! Do it!
Sometimes we talk about the use of color in
films. Yeah! Yeah! Yeah!
Of course, green is a big one in this movie.
Quite.
And something I noticed, there were a couple different things that kind of popped out at me this time around.
Cool.
And I'm trying to find where I wrote this stuff down. But, you know, you got the green liquid.
Yep.
You got the lighting of, you got the trees outside when the three guys are talking. In the parking lot. Mm-hmm. I also noticed there was a green glow, like a green light coming from some of the buildings in the background in that scene.
Right.
The paint on some of the rooms of the church is green. And as someone who's been in his share of old churches, green, especially that kind of faded pea green, is kind of a par for the course. I have no idea why that was ever a thing, but but something else I found interesting, and I was kind of going back and forth with this, was Catherine's coat that she wears is like, I would say it's kind of a shade of light pistachio. And then I'm like, does that kind of, I was thinking, is that, was there a bit of foreshadowing in that bit of wardrobe maybe for her?
Yeah.
So, What are your thoughts on green? What does the green mean, Bill? Enlighten me.
Well, it's a multifaceted symbolic, you know, it has multi, you know, well, it's a symbolic color. It it could be, you know, renewal, nature, or energy. And a lot of times it's often like, you know, complements, you know, growth, obviously, harmony in its own, you know, something fresh and new. Also fertility, and environment, but
well, that does figure into the film in a sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also traditionally associated with things like money and finances and banking and ambition and greed, jealousy, you know? So, I think all three come into play in this movie.
So things that are more like avarice kind of, ties into it.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. Well, you do have this great, you know, you have this energy, this green energy, that wants to bring its own type of harmony to the world. It's growing in regards to, it wants its own spawn so we could, you know, become flesh on, you know, on the earth. It's fertile ground for growth. You know, it is now part of the environment, you know, and it wants to affect the environment. And it's, you know, a lot of people, when they associate, talk about money, you know, like, you know, the root of all evil, there it is.
Yeah, there you know? Go.
And we have also the great elements associated with it, like greed and jealousy. So they all tie in to everything that John Carpenter has brought into the movie.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. I like that. Cause I really had no idea, about the significance of the color. Cause you're like the expert on that stuff.
Oh
so.
God, I don't know about that. But one of the great things though, like in a biblical sense, and this goes back to Psalms 1:3, the leaf shall not wither. Is green is associated with immortality.
Ah, I like that.
And that, I think, fits perfectly with the green goo swirling about. And Greg Palko needs to get a green goo container spinning in his house to
please
fit in the
mold. Please tell me Greg Palko loves this film as much as we do.
I don't know.
Oh boy, we need to. Well, I guess we'll find out after the show posts.
Yeah, exactly. But
that would be a badass prop for his place.
Oh yeah, that would be great. Shut all the lights off and watch this thing spin.
Yeah.
And then maybe once in a while it'll like spit shit at your.
I was gonna say you'll never own a lava lamp ever again.
Yeah. But so the immortal thing is like, and you know, you brought this up before. We didn't even talk about it.
Sure.
Those whole, you know, dream sequences. Those.
Yes.
Those to me are some of the scariest things ever filmed, man. You know, he's walking around with a simple, like, you know, right out of the gutter, you know, $10, although it wasn't 10 bucks back then. Yeah. You know, VHS, you know, you know, ViewMaster thing, you know, like, let's film this on cruddy tape and do a playback. And it's creepy, man. It's creepy of this image of this new master.
Yeah.
Coming through the church doors.
Yeah, you know, Bill, I think that was probably really cutting edge for that time because...
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Because Carpenter's films, I would say, are much... In the way he films them, it's very traditional kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. He grew up, I guess, like on John Ford and Howard Hawks and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I feel like those were like kind of the influences on his aesthetic overall. But, you know, the insertion of those video sequences is really interesting because there's no they're dreams. Yeah. So there's no way to ground someone or to prepare them for that. He just cuts from one scene into like this different type of stock, basically, the grainy. Mm-hmm. Shot on video stock.
Yeah.
And you're totally like
very muted.
Yeah, you're totally taken aback by it too, because you know what we've seen up to that point are, you know, clean, very professional camera movements and all mm-hmm. that stuff. And here we have this very rough handheld type imagery, and for a while you have no idea what it is, you know.
Exactly. And and the audio with it is just like, it's like the signal coming from another universe. You know, and the voice and all, it's just like, what the hell is going? It's just, it's frightening. It's awesome.
You know, Bill, a true story. I think my first exposure to the dialogue that plays over those video sequences was when I first listened to Marilyn Manson's cover of Down in the Park, which samples that at the very beginning of the song.
I love it, man.
Yeah, I think that was the order. I think I heard that song first, and then I saw the movie sometime after it, and I was like, "Holy shit, that's from that song!" Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic, man.
Yeah.
Oh man, it just he created you know, the movie had atmosphere, and John Carpenter created an atmosphere around you viewing it, which is mm-hmm. really interesting. And yeah, you know, for people who are like, this isn't your typical, you know, Carpenter film. There's some gore in this, man. There's a woman who does not become attractive at all at one point.
I was going to say she puts on her Freddy Krueger makeup.
Oh my God. Father. It's like, get away from me, man. Get away from me.
It's like Ray Wise in RoboCop. Get the fuck away from me, man. Also 1987.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll buy that for a dollar. But anyway.
What, you got some green goo in a canister that's 7 million years old? I'd buy that for a dollar.
Yeah, exactly. And
can I have you both?
Get the new SUX 3000. Oh, I love, man. That movie's brilliant. But anyway, thank you, Mr. Verhoeven. One of the things I thought was, you know, at first, I didn't like this. This is when I thought like the movie dragged a little bit. It's like, the Dennis Dunn stuck in a closet, and you know, this, you know, former colleague now, you know, like her skin's turning inside out and all this crazy crap, and they're just watching it forever and ever and ever, and it's like such a lull. And then I'm realizing, no, this fits the characters are scared to death. They're not going to move anywhere. They're not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. They don't know what's happening. And it's like they hadn't been sleeping for like, you know, X million hours. And they're all exhausted and freaked out. And so it actually fit. It was a great lull in regards to it was necessary. It's not like, you know, John Carpenter was like, you know, took a break from writing that scene or filming it in a particular way. It's like, no, there's going to be a gestation period. And, you know, devil's been doing his thing, so to speak. Maybe, we don't know. And the characters are beat. And distraught, and so this is what's going to take place and the way it's going to happen. So, well,
yeah, and I agree with you, Bill. That is, I think that's really real.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why I appreciate. I went from being like, "Oh man," to like, "Oh no, no, this works. This makes sense for the narrative."
Yeah, because by the time Lisa Blount is saying, like, just offhandedly, the sun's coming up, it's like, man, you guys have had a long fucking night with no sleep,
yeah,
basically, you know, and it's been, you know, the party to end all parties, as it were.
Mm. Sounds like a line from Wishmaster. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, Bill.
Go ahead.
Do you have any explanation for the recurring image, at least in the beginning of the film, before they get to the church, really?
I know where you're going.
It's the image of the sun in the sky with the moon hanging above it, sort of like as a winking eye, almost.
Yeah, I'm going to try and see if that's...
It's okay if you don't know.
No. You know, that was the one thing I didn't get a chance to really investigate, but...
Yeah.
Now, usually when you see, like, a circular shape of, like, a half moon and a half sun thing, it's like, you know, the circle of life kind of thing.
Okay. Coming full circle, maybe?
Yeah, sun with the, let's see, because sun with the moon above it, right?
Yeah, it's like the sun shining, and it's almost like,
oh no, I know what it is. I just want to make sure
it's
right.
It's like the fingernail. It's weird because is it the moon? It's like the moon in this odd eclipse state almost.
Yeah, it is, but it's like
I don't even know if I can explain it properly.
Yeah, okay. No, I know. Let's see. Da-da-da-da. I don't know if it. I don't think that happens in nature.
Okay. Yeah,
And that's one of the things that did bother me about the movie. And I sort of wanted to, it sort of freaks me out. Like, it's like, why was that in there?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like people were like, and I put it towards because it wasn't on the news. Like, you wonder if like the devil was already getting to them, messing with their heads.
Okay.
And they're like looking at that and they're like, that's weird. And they're physicists. They know how the universe works and they're not even responding to it. No one's like, dude, take a look at the freaking sky. You know, no one's doing that. And it's almost like they're like ignoring the fantastical.
Well, Bill, you know,
because it doesn't fit into, you know, a psychic, a physics based timeline or
a realm of explanation.
Absolutely.
You know, that actually brings up a line. It's sort of just alluded to, but it's when Victor Wong and Donald Pleasance, because they're the first ones to witness the canister, and there's a book, which we haven't even talked about, that accompanies this canister down in the basement.
Right, yeah.
And something I just find creepy is the fact that it's this huge book that's been written and rewritten over and everything.
Yeah.
Which sort of ties into like notions of the Bible being passed down over the years, like, you know, the stories were distorted or changed based on whoever had a hold of it. But Donald Pleasance has this line, you know, do you feel it? It's a change, you know, a change in the earth that's been going on for like the past month. So maybe that's in a way alluding to that odd configuration of the sun and the moon. I don't know.
Maybe. No, I know. It's just, man, I wish we had a physicist with us right now.
I don't know any physicists.
I don't know either. I did. I knew one. I knew a physics professor out of Portugal, but I'm no longer in touch with him. It's you're like, there's this classic image by Inga Nielsen, and it's called Hideaway, and it shows this it's a picture of the sun actually below a large moon above it, and you just see the slightest crescent of it because of the way it appears. It's supposed to be happening up in the Arctic and all, and it's just a piece of art because that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Cuz like the earth and the moon, they don't that plane of rotation is just like, it's just not right. It just doesn't happen. You know, we have our eclipses and all, but we, man, there's never been in history, you know, seeing something like that. So I just, I don't know. I was wondering, like, what the hell? And I think this ties into maybe some people knowing that something's wrong, but they can't put their finger on it. Or again, how many times do we know something's wrong, but we don't do anything about it, or we look the other way, or, well, that doesn't seem right, but, well, da-da, I got to go get my latte. And I think that's what's happening with our dear professor and even the priest. You know, the priest is recognizing, all right, something's not right, but, like, you know, for Victor Wong's character to, like, look out and, you know, put the hand over his eyes, you know, to shield the sun and to look up and squint and to just, and to be like, that's not right, and to go in the office, that's weird.
Well, you know, Bill, you saying all of that, it made me think of something, and maybe it's a unifying factor between science and religion in this film, is the fact that both, I guess, to do your jobs properly, you have to accept, you know, things that might not be possible in a sense, even though I think both disciplines, you know, religion is very much governed by, you know, rigidity and rules, I feel.
So science.
And so is science. So maybe there's that commonality, but you also have that each one kind of requires you to accept that, oh, well, there might be the possibility of this. Like, well, the priest might believe there's a possibility of a miracle, or that God could manifest in some way. Just as, yeah, go ahead.
And it's interesting because religion, you know, take it on faith, and science, take it on fact. Yet we do have one unifying factor in the whole movie, which is the tachyon.
Yes.
And the tachyon's great because it's a hypothetical faster than light particle. And the thing is that since it does that, there's a chance that that maybe it would be able to be sort of like a gateway in time.
And that's the whole thing of what the what they believe the dreams are that they're getting.
Well, they're guessing, they're hope, maybe it's like, well, it could be from tachyons, and it's like, but still, like, they can't even prove it with their science, and they can't prove it with their religion. And the point is, this could be something w well beyond any type of reality that either, you know, group could imagine. So it's sort of irrelevant. You know, he's saying, yeah, it could be tachyons, but that it's still theoretical, just as it was 30 years ago.
You know, Bill, and can I, and on that note, can I refer back to a scene which
Yeah.
I absolutely adore in this movie,
Sure.
and it ties back to the book that's in the basement,
Oh, yeah, the book. Oh, my God, I forgot about that one.
the one that Lisa, Mona Lisa, translates. But I love the scene where she's explaining or reading the trans, or essentially giving them the Cliff's Notes version of what the book is saying. That the container was buried in the Middle East by the father of Satan. Christ later came to warn us he was of extraterrestrial ancestry, but a human-like race. Christ was gaining power, so they killed him. And the disciples kept, and I guess the Brotherhood of Sleep kept the container a secret until mankind could come up with a science that could explain it. And I just find all the notions in that very chilling. And also, to that end, this is not the type of dialogue you hear in a horror movie or even really a mainstream movie that's dealing with matters of faith. You wouldn't entertain the notion that Christ was an alien, you know.
Yeah, and some people, you know, do believe that and all, and you can believe whatever the hell you want, you know,
Exactly. Yeah,
which is
exactly.
fine. I mean,
But you watch, I mean, sorry, you watch something like The Last Temptation of Christ, and it's presenting it more, it's not a bad movie by any means, but it's being presented more in a, what am I thinking of? I don't want to say in a literal sense, but more of just in a maybe the way it was written kind of sense. I don't know. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that bit of explanation, Bill, if you think, because even the character like halfway through says this is where it gets really crazy, and I love that too about it.
Well, the beauty of it is, if you look at it logically, it's like, well, who wrote that too? Who wrote that? A man. Men wrote that. So anytime you want to convince something of somebody, the best way, I think, to freak people out over time is to write something and let it try and stand that test of time. And if somebody gets a hold of it, they can manipulate that document, edit it any way they want. And that's why I really enjoyed how it's like, yeah, see how they keep rewriting over the document?
Yeah.
Right, in spots? And that's because, you know, and that took me right back to the Bible because, you know, you look at some segments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we would, you know, many would consider to be like the only original platform for the Bible. Yet, so many of those stories have been rewritten, re-edited by redactors.
Yes.
And rewritten again over and over and over again. And you wonder, it's like, well, did some king want a change so it could help him control his people more? That came up in the Book of Eli, right? When characters like, hey, man, you know, with this book, you know, we could, like, you know, rule the world, you know, or something like that.
Gary
right?
fucking Oldman, yeah. Yeah,
totally, right? That's why he wanted it. He's like, no, we need this. He was going to use it as a weapon. And things happen used as a weapon. So who knows? Could that, again, you know, the devil, the prince of lies, could that whole thing be just a lie just to further mess with people's heads so he could just go and just, like, walk into the room and own it?
Well, and, you know, going back to a point you made, Bill, about the book being written by a man, I think about that last thing she says about the science that can, you know, science finally catching up to it.
Right.
And it's almost like with that, it's like, well, there is a bit of hubris there. It's like, well, oh, congratulations, you finally made it, suckers, and here you are, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, exactly.
Basically? Yeah.
What happened to the American dream? It came true. You know, yeah, it's one.
Billy invested so much into tachyon research with Dr. Manhattan. Come on.
That'd be great. Oh, man, if Dr. Manhattan showed up and said, I have the answer.
Totally take me out of the movie.
Yeah, it would. If it's like, look at that blue penis.
I was going to say his dangling sack would be totally at odds with the swirling green canister.
Oh, Dr. Manhattan. Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think the whole movie has to deal with, you know, where is there truth in the deception, and is there deception in the truth? And I think that's part of, you know, anybody who's come across any dealings with someone of a B cluster personality disorder, who's a psychopath, a sociopath, they tell lies like crazy, but there's always a tad of truth that will keep you guessing. And that's the scary part, and that's why they're so effective. And in this movie, that has that, you know, at almost every turn. You know, like, what am I really seeing, hearing, feeling, and everything else? And that's why the ending, which, you know, we're not going to give away, obviously, but that's why the ending is one of my favorites in all of horror.
Well, Bill, you were talking about the, what was it? Did you say the type B personality?
Yeah. It's a cluster B personality disorder.
The cluster B personality, that's kind of interesting because, you know, you could say that the the canister and what's in it is the type B personality in the film.
Of course.
And even Jameson Parker at one point says, you know, it's reaching out, it's influencing, it's conscious, which I think is an extremely chilling line because it's like...
That's what I would have been running out the friggin' door, man.
You're trying to quantify something that's not human and has no real human characteristics, and you're saying not only humans can be conscious, but, I mean, that was just chilling to me. You know, you have this object that just has this stuff in it, and it's awake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Again, take your classical reality and just throw it out the window.
Well, Bill, you know, I know you said you didn't want to talk about the ending, but...
Yeah. Let's go. Let's do it. Why not?
It's 30 fucking years old, man.
I know. Let's go for it.
Spoiler alert if you haven't seen the movie.
If you haven't figured out that this was a spoiler alert.
And you made it this far. But the something, I don't know. I always had trouble with this. And granting, when I watched it the last time, I was taking notes like a madman on it. But Catherine and her issue with classical reality, I guess, and trying to see past that.
Yeah.
And that totally... the way she screws up her face at the end of the movie when she sees what's coming through the mirror.
Yeah.
Is it like, do you feel like, how do you interpret that? I mean, is she just overwhelmed by, granted, the total nonsensical thing she's seeing? I mean, that makes no logical sense.
Well, that was it. I think it was like all of those guesses and all suddenly became like, oh my gosh, this is real.
It was actualized.
Yeah, absolutely. It was actualized, and she is the hero. She's going to take action and save. Oh man, what? And the way they filmed that whole thing, holy hell, man! I was just like, wow, just oh.
Well, because you know, because Carpenter puts in a shot that is like 2-3 seconds, and it totally twists the knife. It's actually a really heartbreaking moment in the film. And, you know, Jameson Parker, he's like screaming no to the priest, you know, when he throws the axe after Catherine pushes Kelly through the mirror. Yeah. So, and that shot of her just like reaching out as the doorway closes, kind of.
Yeah. And then it's great. And, you know, he has his own little dream.
Yeah.
And, you know, cause, and is it out of hope? And oh man, does he want to like? Oh, what an ending, man! It's just so awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of impact there, and the interesting thing about that ending, Bill, is there's not really an epilogue to it.
No, you know, it just gives you chills.
Yeah, it doesn't. It really doesn't. It doesn't go on for like 20 minutes like a Marvel movie would after.
Oh yeah, the movie's over. The denouement is now taking place for 50 minutes.
Yeah, go take a piss. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and don't come back.
Yeah.
No, and with this, it was great because it was a gasp-worthy ending because it's like, you know, Jameson Parker, he's perfect. He's got the perfect look on his face.
Perfect and mustache.
Yes, exactly, and he's perplexed, and he's also like, can it? Will it? Could it? And, you know, he's reaching out. The music flares up. A great close-up of his hand going towards this mirror. And it's getting closer and closer. And you could see, I could imagine Carpenter with the editor, you know, like looking at this footage. Okay, he said, I'll tell you when to cut. I'll tell you, you know what I mean? And that's exactly what happens. Yeah, Steve Merkovich was the editor. I could see him like, cut it now. No, keep going. But he's really getting close. Cut, keep going, keep going. That's like, now, stop it, you know? Fade to black. No, don't cut to black and roll credits and have everybody freak the fuck out.
Well, you know, Bill, I thought that was great. And it's just such a Carpenter ending there, you know? It ends on that note of ambiguity like we kept talking about The Thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That film ends on a note of extreme ambiguity, but it's you don't feel like it's not like, oh, fuck you, in the sense of you just gave a short shrift. It's like, fuck you, you did such a great job, sort of thing.
Yeah, well, this to me is the best ending that John Carpenter ever did.
Seriously?
Absolutely.
Wow. That's
absolutely. The Thing would have been up there if he had it where we go, let's just sit here for a while and see what happens. And then they fade to daylight and we see the burnt camp and we see a dog running from it. That would have been phenomenal, but he didn't do that.
Didn't you say, Bill, they did that for the TV version?
Yeah, when I saw that on the TV version, I was like, that's the ending! I don't know how old I was, like 20 or some shit. And I was like, maybe less than that. And I was like, that's the way it should have ended in the film.
It's like Billy's yelling at the TV again.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, my mom, keep it down in there! Sorry, Mom!
Well, Bill, I know we just talked about the ending, but I wanted to make one more point about the film.
Yeah.
What do you think about the means that the characters have to combat, you know, their colleagues who are turning into zombies and servants of the devil? Like how we were talking about Victor Wong's Shasta and chopstick trick earlier.
Yeah.
But, you know, the priest uses an axe at the end of the film. They use bricks that were jarred loose from the wall to.
Yeah, they just beat their heads in.
I got to say, I love the scene where Dennis Dunn knees Lisa in the groin.
Yeah, he's pounded on her like a bastard. No, I loved it. I loved it because it was so visceral. It was so primal. You know, you have a stick, you have a rock, you have water. Yeah. Like, he's used all these basic, like, prime materials to combat evil. No guns, no, like, you know, cruise missiles or nuclear weapons. It's like, it's very 2001 A Space Odyssey fighting at the monolith.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. And watching it, I was like, yeah, I felt like it made sense, especially like after all the technology goes down and you find out you do actually have to fight for your life in this situation. I thought it made a lot of sense. It's funny because I was thinking about this, and I know you have heated sentiments toward him to begin with, but Roger Ebert's review, and I'm going to quote it here.
Oh, God, here I go. I'm going to go off, am I? Go ahead.
Well, you know what? I think he misses the point.
Well, I'm shocked.
But he says, let's face it, when a movie promises us the Prince of Darkness, we expect more than a green thing in a tube that sprays fluids into people's mouths, turning them into zombies who stand around for most of the movie looking like they can't remember which bus to take. When we're threatened with Armageddon, we expect more than people hitting each other over the head with 2x4s.
He's such a douchebag. Does he, like, it's like he goes in with these preconceived notions, man.
Well, I think, you know, I think the thing is he, like a lot of critics.
They're like, where's the monster?
Well, and horror was much more dismissed back in the era that, you know, before the internet came along and it turned out everybody with a computer was a horror fan.
Yeah.
You know, you had these critics who sort of turned their noses up at the genre. And I think with there were certain exceptions with him because, you know, I told you he gave May a 4-star review.
Yes.
And
he had his moments.
Yeah, he did. But I just was like, I think he was missing the point because, granted, I've watched
like he did with Fight Club. Mm-hmm.
And granted, I've probably watched Prince of Darkness over a dozen times over my lifetime at this point. But
oh, I'd probably, you know, about 40 times for me right now. Go ahead, man. Sorry, bud.
Yeah, I usually watch it a couple times a year. I never got to a point where I was watching it once a week. But but I think, like, to the point I brought up about how everything starts to fail, you're going to be reaching for whatever is in reach.
Of course.
If they're going to spit in your mouth and turn you into a zombie for Satan, well, if the 2x4 is the closest thing you have, you're going to use a 2x4.
Man, that chopstick, that was just jab it in your eye, anything, man.
Yeah, exactly. If it's like a old Sunday school desk with one of the things to write on, you're going to slam that in someone's face.
Part of, you know, part of combat training or any type of training in self-defense is to put as much distance between you and your opponent. And if that means grabbing a pot and throwing it at their head, as silly as it sounds, as Three Stooges-like as it sounds, you do that. You do anything to get an advantage to keep the enemy at bay until you get a, you know, hopefully, you know, you get a leg up, so to speak.
Well, Bill, and I know that's something you brought up when we were talking about dog
soldiers. Dog soldiers, yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, yeah. Oh, that was funny. What are you, stupid? You know, and he did that in Atomic Blonde, too. Same thing. It's like, what is near me that I could pick up and throw? And it didn't matter what it was, you know?
Well, and I think something the two of us hate, going back to, like, the notion of, oh, it's like, oh, something horrible's happening. Let's just stand here and watch it happen, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is that, you know, these characters are taking action. And, you know, they're taking it as best they can. And, like,
they're academics. They're not fighters.
Exactly.
The guy's, like, a priest. He's not a fighter either.
Yeah, it's like Donald Pleasance wasn't at the gym doing kickboxing to prepare for his big bout with Satan, you know?
I heard he was. That's a rumor. But anyway.
That's a deleted scene, I think.
A deleted scene. I love you. Can you imagine?
Feed me, Donald. Feed me.
I'll be back.
I just was like, you know, some people, I'm sure people could say it's like, oh, well, you know, John Carpenter was falling back on the tropes of the genre where it's just like you use these items because they've been used in movies previously of this type. But I think thinking more about it, it's like, no, it's just all that stuff was born out of necessity.
Yeah. What would you do to survive? Anything possible?
Yeah, exactly.
And it
So,
happens every day. And yeah. Oh man.
yeah.
Ah,
So, do
love
you have
it.
any final thoughts on Prince of Darkness, Bill, before we scream it on out of here?
Yeah, I tell people just watch the damn movie and enjoy it. And when you're done watching it, give it another whirl.
It's a movie you will want to give another whirl.
Damn straight.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't even want to say it because it'll probably happen after I say it. I am so glad that this movie has not been considered for the REMAKE treatment.
No, it doesn't deserve it.
Well, it doesn't need it. You
No, it
know,
doesn't
it's.
need it. Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure people are just like. I'm sure enough people are still just baffled by it and don't know what to make of it that I don't know that that would ever become a feasible notion.
Oh yeah, I'm with you on that, man. Oh
So,
yeah.
I think that's something to be appreciated and admired about this film 30 years later.
Yeah, love it. And it's a shame so many of the some of those stars aren't with us anymore. Like
Did
Donald
Victor Wong
Pleasance.
pass away?
I was just gonna look it up. I think he did pass on.
I think Peter Jason passed away. He was Leahy.
Oh, really? Yeah, he did, didn't he? Oh, wait, hold
Yeah.
on. Yeah, because he was, oh man, he's a blast in that.
Hit
No, he
his
is still with us, man.
Oh shit, sorry. Sorry,
That's
Peter.
okay. He is, what is he, 82? He's born in 44. He's still with us. Lisa Blount, we lost in
Yeah.
2012 or 10, I believe, which is awful. The great Victor Wong, he did, yeah, he passed away in 2001. I always like to think he's still around, man, because he was just cool as hell. His last movie was Three Ninjas, High Noon at Mega Mountain. He was Grandpa Maury. Oh, man.
Yeah, you know what? I would want him in the room if it were the apocalypse. That's all I gotta
Damn
say.
straight, man. Because he could take Lo Pan out, and he could take anybody out, man.
Well, and you know, Bill, I wanted to mention this as well as the fact that to the end of like the casting of the leads with Donald Pleasance and Victor Wong. Victor Wong is just like he's this small guy. You don't see him as being like this formidable kind of fighter, but you
Right.
know, he fights with his mind and with his can of Shasta, so you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And for those keeping score, Dennis Dunn will be appearing in the movie Something Horrible. He plays Randolph Carter.
Wow.
So just so you know. All right, man. So, dude, this is a long show. We got to do the scream outs and
Yeah,
scream it.
go ahead.
All right, here we go. People on Twitter, so follow them, man. Here we go. UK Horror Scene. They're now a social media only news outlet for anything horror related. And tweets are by the great editor Andy Dean 666. And you can email them at ukhorrorscene@mail.com. And also go to their website, ukhorrorscene.com. They are awesome. The wonderful, the vivacious, the enigmatic, the phenomenal, the hardcore awesome Melanie Wise at I Am Melanie Wise. She's an
Yes.
actor, producer, the principal behind Artemis Pictures, and the founder of the Artemis Film Fest, which continues to grow every year. Check them out at artemismotionpictures.com and artemisfilmfestival.com. She is fantastic. A fiend on film. Who is that? That is the great Dave Kay. And he is the man who loves horror, noir, Indian foreign films, art, graphic design, architecture. Check him out at magnificentworldofdavek.wordpress.com.
Oh, Bill, quick.
Yo.
The House of Skin fanzine devoted to David Cronenberg coming in 2018.
Yes.
Volunteer your time and talents. Write about him, draw about him, and send it off to Fiend.
Absolutely. And speaking of cool people who are fiends as well, in a very excellent sense, Dread Central, badassery, awesomeness, and horror, breaking news, original content, and active community in horror. You could contact them as well as info at dreadcentral.com and go to their website, dreadcentral.com. Promote horror. Welcome to PromoteHorror.com, where they bring creators of horror and horror fans together. That's exactly what they do. Their goal is to help spread the horror through their promotions, and that is at PromoteHorror.com. We mentioned him before, Palco Designs,
Yeah.
and that is the great Greg Palco. He's a lover, collector, and designer of horror. And I tell you, he's incredible. Posters, media kits, book covers, award-winning graphic designer, by the way. because he's won many awards with the wonderful Ron Shaw. Ron Shaw is also known as Ron Gizmo. You could find him at ronshawmedia.com. And he has had Greg design some phenomenal covers. And as far as I know, every book cover that Greg Palko has designed has earned an award. And yeah, that only helps increase book sales. So think of that, authors, please. Yeah. Also, Scream Horror Mag. And that is Scream Magazine. As they say, the world's number one horror mag. And you could buy them all over. And go right to their website. It's phenomenal. ScreamHorrorMag.com. The great Susan. Oh, my God. Susan Layton. Man, did I just like... She is otherwise known as Susan on the Ledge. She's a writer. And a girl, as she says. And you can find out her stuff on 1428 underscore Elm, cult underscore faction. Also at VHS Revival. And she's, and goes also go to thequeenofstyle.com. Okay, ooh, she's really cool. Bringbackboomstick.com. And also IMDb. She's everywhere, man. She's just phenomenal. Go to I am off the ledge.com. blogspot.com. You will not be disappointed. And I just have three more, Johnny. John's Horror Corner, those great people at MFF Horror Corner. It's a great podcast and everything else. Go to movies, flicks, movies. Jeez, I do it every freaking time. Movies, films, and flicks.com. Okay, check them out for podcasts because John's a movie critic. All of it, man. Great podcaster. Another excellent podcast, Good Times, Great Movies, and that's GTGM Cast. And it's a podcast about the best and worst of 80s cinema. Can't miss them. Check them out on iTunes. They have a Patreon now, all this cool stuff. So go to iTunes and check out GTGM. And finally, because she's so super wonderful, and we're recording this on her birthday, and she's happy to say that she's 49 and feeling fine, and that is Real Jilly G. She's a writer, poet, photographer. She's into indie film, The Walking Dead, horror, the whole nine yards. She's been a great supporter of the show as well for many moons. Check out her wonderful writing at crimsonquintessence.com. Awesome. Johnny, that's it.
Well, Billy, where can people find you?
I'm right here. I'm well aware. You can find me on Twitter at Crash Palace, and you could find this show and more at the brand new CrashPalaceProductions.com website, thanks to the phenomenal Brian Yunt. And go to BrianYunt.com, and that is Y-O-U-N-T. He's a phenomenal website designer. And he's done incredible work to make sure that this changeover has been as smooth as possible. And we know the site's been down for a couple of weeks, but we appreciate everybody's patience. But it was in need of an upgrade, an update, and everything else. And more new things are coming. Okay, Johnny, you.
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Numb. There are no H's in those Johnnies. And you can also find my movie reviews in addition to the brand spanking new Crash Palace Productions website at loudgreenbird.com.
Yes, please go to Loud Green Bird because Bill Meeker is awesome, a.k.a. Frisco Kid TX. Awesome stuff.
Yeah, it's a good bunch of people to hang out with, definitely.
Damn straight. Yeah, we have to meet like in the middle of the country and have a party or something like that.
We need to do NotCon, Bill.
I love it. We'll talk.
we'll talk after the show.
Yeah. All right, man. You have a good one, buddy.
You too, Bill. Beware the tachyons.
Bye.
Bye.